Tech of Sports, episode 13 for June 6, 2012. Writer and former NBA basketball player, Paul Shirley. This week on the Tech of Sports, Paul Shirley. Netcast Studio mobile apps are a great way to receive our content, your content for your smart devices. There's an app for both iOS and Android. And don't forget the Stitcher radio app for all iOS devices and Android. Get Stitcher for free with your favorite Netcast Studio shows preloaded. Stitcher Radio, award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone and tablet. Stitcher, it's smart radio for your smartphone. The Tech of Sports is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network at techpodcast.com. If it's tech, it's here. And the Tech of Sports is a production of Netcast Studio at netcaststudio.com. You can join us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific at netcaststudio.com/live, where you can join the chat room and listen to the show live. Welcome, everybody, tonight. Tonight, we're going to talk about more than just sports and more than just tech with a guest who I feel is qualified to talk about them all. It's Paul Shirley, former starter and all-academic Big 12 basketball player and a second-team academic All-American basketball player at, you know, my alma mater, Iowa State. He then played in the NBA for the likes of the Atlanta Hawks, Chicago Bulls, and Phoenix Suns. He also was invited to NBA training camps for the likes of the Los Angeles Lakers and the Minnesota Timberwolves. He also played professionally overseas in Spain, Russia, and Greece. And he penned a popular ESPN blog back in 2004-2005 when he was with the Phoenix Suns, chronicling his life during the playoff run. And then after that, he went on to write a book, Can I Keep My Jersey, which was published by Random House. He now writes about music, sports, and whatever else interests him. And Paul, I appreciate you taking some time and joining tonight.
Of course. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to live up to that intro, but I'll do my best.
You don't have to. All you got to do is show up.
That's right. I guess I don't have to write anything on the air. I just have to speak.
Yeah, it's a little different for you. I just wanted to point one thing out to you, and maybe you're aware of it, maybe you're not. But when you were with the Chicago Bulls, you wore the number 45, and that number 45 Chicago Bulls jersey happens to be one of the biggest selling jerseys in NBA history. Did you realize that or get a cut of any of that?
Yeah, I think it was due to the popularity of that book I wrote, for sure. No, I did not. I didn't do that on purpose. I was actually, I remember this vividly. I was in high school when Michael Jordan came out of his little mini retirement, and he took number 45, which was my high school jersey, and I groaned because I knew people would think then that I picked 45 because of Michael Jordan. So then when I went to the Bulls, whatever, how many, 10 years later or something, and they asked for what number I wanted to be, I thought nothing of it and assumed that someone must have been 45 in between us and was wrong, because the best player in the history of the Bulls was 45, and then possibly the worst player in the history of the Bulls followed him up with number 45 also.
Don't say that, but it, for those that don't know, Michael Jordan was 23 most of his career, and then when he came back after, you said, his mini retirement, he took the number 45 jersey, and that's what you wore during your stint.
During my ill-fated stint with the Bulls, yes.
I won't say brief stint. I'll just say stint with
the, it was pretty brief. I signed a contract to be there for like a third of a season, but I only played in, I don't know, six games because I blew out my kidney and spleen in the seventh game. And like, it's interesting. I was telling someone today that one of the unique aspects of my career and my writing career afterward was that I was always super self-deprecating, because that's what I was known for. I was the guy who didn't play, and so I kind of made fun of myself and that fact, in part because I come from this Midwestern background where you don't, you know, do any sort of self-aggrandizing. And what people forget a lot of the time is that I was actually a pretty good basketball player. When I was with the Bulls and right before I went down with that massive internal injury, I was actually playing quite a lot. But then the next year I went to the Phoenix Suns and became the 12th man and sort of poked enough fun at myself that everyone assumed that that's what I was for perpetuity.
Yeah, and there's been comedians and actors that have made, you know, a good living, you know, making fun of themselves for years and years. And I think there's always room for someone like that. I don't think you were making fun of yourself. You were more just kind of saying what was on your mind and telling the truth, I think, in most cases.
Yeah, that's true. I think one of the... When I was a kid, my middle name is Murphy, so my initials are PMS, which is not the best set of initials to have in the world. My mother's a nurse, and she maintains that they hadn't coined the term yet when I was born, which recently I debunked. That is not true. They had coined the term. But anyway, the point of the story is that when I was a kid, I didn't know how to make fun of myself. And so when my middle school teammates or classmates, whatever, found out that these were my initials, they just made fun of me to no end. Oh. And I hadn't yet learned to just say, yeah, that's really crazy, isn't it? That's pretty stupid that that's my middle name. And once you learn that trick that it's best to make fun of yourself more aggressively, no one can then make fun of you to any sort of degree that will hurt your feelings. And so I think comedians and writers learn that pretty quickly. I learned it maybe because of PMS, but found it to be effective in writing about basketball because I could say that I was wrong or that something was wrong with me, and then that gave me the ability to criticize the league itself, other players, whatever.
Right. Yeah, I mean, people have said you kind of made the NBA by accident, but you were actually a better than average college player, and being 6'10", almost 6'11", doesn't hurt. When did you realize that maybe you could make an NBA roster? Was it when you were doing all those, defensive drills with Tim Floyd and Larry Eustace? Was that in the back of your mind at all, or were you just kind of going to freewheel it? Once I'm done playing in college, let's see what happens.
Well, I think all basketball players would probably answer this the same way, because in order to ever make it, you need to be slightly delusional. I thought at 13 or 14 years old that I would play in the NBA. I, though, because of maybe that modest Midwestern background, would never have admitted that. I never would have said that out loud, but it was always in the back of my mind. Like when I was training in the summertime, whatever, the goal was always to make it to the professional level. I thought that one day the Boston Celtics would retire my jersey and I would, follow in Larry Bird's footsteps and, have that career that everyone dreams of. Of course, that didn't happen. I got, in a relative sense, closer than most, but it wasn't like a whim or some sort of lark. I was very serious about playing basketball. I knew, though, that I just wasn't quite good enough or didn't have the pedigree maybe to waltz my way into it. I actually went to Iowa State on an academic scholarship. I was not highly recruited coming out of high school, and I certainly wasn't sought after coming out of college. So I had to find ways to make it. For me, that was doing well in school. That kind of got some notice. That was trying to be personable and relatable and being the guy that wasn't going to get caught raping someone at midnight or whatever. So I found my niche, which was, be the good guy who shows up on time, plays hard. And it was the thing that got me to the NBA, albeit briefly.
Yeah, you were a team player and, you gave yourself up on the defensive end a lot. And you played hard. In addition to the NBA, you also played overseas. And, in your book, we'll talk about that in a bit, you talk about playing in Russia and Spain and Greece, and where basketball actually, now it's played at a pretty high level. And, there's Americans over there playing, and it's pretty serious. The one question I have, tell us a little bit about your playing over there, but also, are you still owed money by any of those teams is what I'm kind of wondering. Because you hear the horror stories of the pros coming back, and all of them are owed. It doesn't matter if you're Dominique Wilkins or whoever. They always come back saying they stiffed me.
Yeah. I oddly enough, the only place that does not owe me money is Russia, which is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. I am owed $13,000 by a team in Spain. Probably won't ever get that. I suppose it's possible. It's way more likely than I'll ever get the $52,000 that I'm owed by a team in Greece, which sounds maybe like not that much money if you're a professional athlete, but I didn't make that much money in my career. So $52,000 is a lot of money to me. The Greeks, no offense if either of you is Greek, but they're not particularly good with money, as is being demonstrated by the crisis in the European Union right now. That crisis didn't come as much of a surprise to me because I experienced this firsthand. When I signed this contract, we're among friends, so we'll just tell the truth. I signed a contract for $100,000 to play basketball in Greece, which is amazing, right? Like someone's going to pay me $100,000 in 2001 to play basketball. I get there, they give me the first paycheck, and then the second paycheck they give me half, and they say, don't worry, we'll pay you the rest avrio, which means tomorrow in Greek. And so tomorrow I ask, so when are you going to pay me the rest of this month's check? And they say, oh, avrio. So that's what they say in Greece a lot is avrio. You learn that word very quickly. They continued doing that, and I learned that in Greece, Greek law doesn't protect the worker very well, so you can't go on strike unless the team or the entity gets 3 months behind on your paycheck. So the Greeks were smart. They would just stay consistently 3 months behind, and then the season ended, and they said, oh, we still owe you money, but what are you going to do about it? So we sue the team, win the lawsuit, team appeals, we win the appeal. And then because so many teams in Greece were in arrears at the time, the Greek like minister of sport or commissioner of sport or something changes the law and says to all these teams, as long as you promise never to do this again, you're forgiven all of your debts and you don't have to pay any of these players. So that $52,000 is never going to be mine, which, again, we're talking about money for basketball. So it's not, you know, we're not talking about Sudanese refugees here, but it is pretty irksome to know that you signed a contract. You said, I'm going to do this for you and you're going to give me this in return. And then that person or group says, no, we're just not going to do that.
Yeah, now with the problem, the Greek monetary problem, how much is that $52,000 even worth now, even if you were getting it? I mean, you may be better off not getting it.
Good luck getting that in drachmas here in 6 months.
Tell us what you're doing now a little bit, and you kind of talked about it when we were talking off the air. You are actually watching the NBA playoffs, and you're writing for El País in out of Spain. And mm-hmm. How do you like doing that, and how's that going?
It's a pretty great gig in that El País is a pretty important newspaper in Spain. I actually didn't know that this gig was as good as it is until I went to Spain. I was actually writing, I think, after my stint playing in Menorca. Then I took a job for Unicaja Malaga, which is a team in Malaga, Spain. I had started doing this weekly column about the NBA, but thought it was just online. Got to Malaga and was sitting in a hospital waiting room, actually, with my girlfriend at the time. And this little boy comes up to me and says, you're Paul Shirley, right? And I'm like, yeah, I am. And I assumed that he just knew me from the fact that I had just signed with Unicaja. But it turns out he says, you're my favorite writer. And I'm like, oh, wow, this kid has amazing internet access. Good for him. And he goes, no, it's here. Today's newspaper has it, because it was Monday. And I have my picture and byline is in El País every Monday writing about the NBA. So it's a great gig in terms of prestige. It's a little weird because I, as we were talking about, my Spanish is okay. I can get by in Spanish, but I can't write well enough that I would produce anything I'm proud of. So I write in English every Thursday and they print it on Monday, which means that I kind of have to predict the future. Like I was working on a column today wherein I have to sort of hedge my bets. Like if Oklahoma City wins, then this happens and that's probably what will go down, but maybe, just maybe, the Spurs will win and that'll kind of change. In addition to that, I write for a website called Chicago Side Sports. I'm working on a series of columns about what it's like to be retired. And I'm just finishing a second book. I write for a website I started called Flip Collective, which is very writerly and usually not sports related. And I sometimes write for absolutepunk.net about music. And I think that about covers it.
Yeah, we'll talk about your love of music here at the end. And are you going to be doing also the same kind of writing for the Olympics basketball? Is that, you know, in the cards as well for El País or anyone in the States?
I think it depends with regard to El País on whether the Spanish economy collapses. But yeah, that's, I think, the plan. But we'll see. They're also in a little bit of trouble. You can actually kind of measure the degree of the chaos in Spain by which countries owe me the most money. Like, it's obviously way worse in Greece, and they owe me about four times as much money as the Spanish do.
Well, at least it's good you're home free with Russia there. But I guess you deserve something for, I mean, you played in Kazan. I guess that's how it's pronounced.
That is how it's pronounced.
And you hear all the horror stories about the planes crashing and the planes that the teams are riding on. Do you still have nightmares about some of those night flights and those planes in the wintertime?
Yeah, it was when I went to Russia, I had always thought, like, your listeners maybe can tell this by now, but I'm not probably the typical basketball player. I was looking at getting to go to Europe as more like an opportunity to live in weird places and experience that. And so before I went to Russia, I had always had the goal of playing in Russia because I thought it would be interesting to see what it was like to live there. I didn't really, though, plan on how strange or terrible it would be to live in Kazan, which is about 500 miles the wrong way from Moscow. And I don't think that really took hold until I had arrived in Moscow in one airport, and this Russian guy who spoke no English picked me up, drove me 2 hours to the other airport in Moscow, dropped me off with like hand signals, made it clear that I was going to have to pay for my luggage later in the day to get on this plane to go to Kazan, and then just abandoned me to the airport for 12 hours. People in Russia do not speak a lot of English, so that was intimidating in and of itself. Then that night, I like found my way after guarding my bags and taking them into the bathroom with me every time I had to go in that airport. I find my way to the airplane. We go out on the tarmac. It's snowing, of course. And I want to take a picture of this plane because it's like Air Siberia and it's snowing. It's November. And I'm like, this is hilarious. I can't believe it's actually called Air Siberia. I mean, I'm sure that's only funny to us. It's not funny to them because Siberia is an actual place. So I get my camera out and I'm ready to take a picture. And this guy comes over. He's like, no. And in that moment, I had flashbacks to like, oh, God, I grew up during the Cold War. And like, maybe this guy's going to take me away. And this is not nearly as fun as I thought it would be. And that kind of informed my entire time there, where it's just, I'm not one to say, like, people are always like, oh, yeah, you know, East Kansas City is a little unsafe. It's not unsafe compared to like being in Johannesburg or something. Anyway, I'm not one to panic about feeling unsafe, but I felt pretty unsafe in Russia most of the time that I was there.
Yeah, and you were a professional athlete. So was it because you were an American? Or I mean, how were the Americans treated there? Were you treated differently than the Russian players on the team? Or was everyone kind of in the same boat?
Well, in a lot of ways, when you're in Europe, you're treated with deference because you're American, because they kind of think that maybe you're a little more volatile or something. But there's a certain amount of pressure on the Americans because there can only be two, usually, in most countries, on each team. So if you're not producing, they will send you home very quickly and figure a way to get out of your contract. So a lot of the time, you're just under a lot more scrutiny. And so you can't, there's a little bit less ability to kind of fly under the radar. And for me, that was always an odd experience or an odd existence because I was not the guy who was going to go in and score 35 points a game. I was the guy who was going to score 12 and like hopefully try to figure out a way for us to win. So I was always kind of worried that I was going to get put on the next Air Siberia flight home.
It's got to be a weird feeling, but I mean, you played under pressure before, so
I think it was a different kind of pressure because you're talking about like your entire, you've uprooted your life and taken it to say Menorca, where I was on the island of Menorca for a year and a half. And at one time, there was the coach or the GM brings me in and says, look, you're averaging whatever, 9 points a game. If you don't play well in the next two games, we're sending you home. And like, if you're completely footloose and fancy free, like I was early in my career, then sure, whatever, I'll go somewhere else. But as you start to get older and as you start to like make connections and like I at that time had a girlfriend, like that starts to weigh on you because you have this other stuff. Now, I was lucky because I didn't have like a wife and two dogs or something. But it's still a little hard on the system. Speaking of that, actually, when I was in Greece, you remember who Dickie Simpkins is?
Sure. Guard. Played for Cincinnati.
Maybe he played for the Bulls for a while. Dickie Simpkins was in training camp with the Lakers with me when I first got out of school. Then I went to Greece and he went to Greece. He played for a different team. We found out we were both in Athens. He had just arrived like December 1st or something like that. So we planned to have a Christmas dinner together, which was really cool. It was him, his wife, two dogs, maybe kids, to be honest, I can't remember. Anyway, Dickie Simpkins gives me a bottle of cologne, which is really nice. I had forgotten to bring a gift because I didn't think we were giving gifts. I thought I was just supposed to bring some wine. Anyway, it goes down that 2 days after Christmas, Dickie Simpkins' team, which is named Marusi, sent him home because he hadn't played well enough. So Dickie Simpkins has brought his entire family to Greece, has been there for 26 days, and the team just like, sorry, buddy, it's not going to work out. Man. So anyway, I was much easier to move around than the Simpkinses, I'm sure.
Yeah, the moral is that, you know, professional basketball is not as glamorous for some of the people as it is for the LeBron James and the Dwayne Wades of basketball. So
yeah, I mean, I think that's something it's a tough thing to explain to people. Even my close friends when I was playing, like I'm obviously not playing now, so they maybe, although now I'm writing and they understand that even less. But when I was playing, it was hard to ever describe my existence because people think, when they think of basketball players, they see the games and the games look like a lot of fun. But there's all this other stuff that goes into being a professional athlete, you know, the obvious training and all of that, but also the mental and emotional warfare of like things going really badly and then recovering from that and trying to play well, or getting cut from a team and then trying to recover from that and going to play somewhere else, or getting hurt or whatever it is. It makes for a weird cocktail of emotions. And the trade-off, or the oddity, I guess, in a career like mine is that I just didn't make that much money. So it wasn't quite like people would have said, well, yeah, that's not that much fun maybe in a lot of cases, but A, you're getting to play a game, and B, you're making so much money that it doesn't matter. I made a little more money than I would have made as an engineer, which is what my degree is in.
Right.
So, you know, like that's, yeah, great. I never want to complain about that, but people tend to not understand the link there.
Yeah. Getting away from basketball for just a second. I mean, you travel a lot. You like to travel. You like to experience life. And when for your writing, what do you carry around with you? What kind of technology, what kind of tools do you carry around when you're on the road? Is it probably less than probably people think?
Yeah. I mean, like that's one good thing about having had this vagabond basketball career. I'm a pretty light traveler. I take a notepad and a pen and my laptop and headphones and a little corded mouse, and I can pretty much set up and do business anywhere in the world, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, much.
So I know this is the tech of sports, so you want me to say, well, like, I can't live without my iPad, but that's not really my style.
Well, we may ask you that in a minute here, but let me just take a quick break. We got to take one break here in the show for an Amazon.com ad. So just grab a sip of water and just for 1 second here, and just want to let the viewers know, especially with Father's Day on the horizon, if you're doing any shopping on Amazon, you can use the studio affiliate link here. It's netcaststudio.com/Amazon for any of your purchases on Amazon, any of your needs. There's no extra cost to you, and it helps support the Netcast Studio family of shows. Once again, it's netcaststudio.com/Amazon. And I always give a pick kind of here, depending on the guest we have on, so it's just a natural to put out there. Can I keep my jersey? 11 teams, 5 countries, and 4 years in your life as a basketball vagabond. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and Kindle, and it make a great a purchase for a basketball fan or a sports fan or just someone that wants to read about your career. It's a great book, and I have 3 copies of it myself. So so that's where those 3 copies went, Paul.
Nice. That's like $3 in my pocket. Yeah.
There you go. There you go. Talk about the book for a second, because you kind of started writing shorter, like a diary blog entries, and then it kind of grew into the book. Was it harder putting the book together? I know you used a little bit of the blog entries were a little bit of the inspiration for the book, but how difficult was it to put the book together after the how you started your writing?
Well, I had started writing when I was first in Greece, to be honest. I arrived in Athens, Greece, was living in a hotel, did not have a lot of internet access. I think I had my old HP Pavilion laptop that I bought actually when I signed the contract. I was fresh out of college, so I had no money. And I remember I signed this contract with my parents and like, oh, I could go buy something and I guess it'll be this laptop. So anyway, take this laptop to I'm kind of, again, not quite like Sean Marion, who would have bought like 2 earrings for $40,000 each or something.
Yeah, where was the Mercedes-Benz or the Bentley at that point?
Yeah, I didn't need one because I was going to Greece, so no need for a Bentley. So anyway, when I first got to Greece, I would write down what was happening to me because I didn't have much internet access, and I would send it out as like a journal kind of update each week to friends and family via email, like the precursor to a blog, because it wasn't posted anywhere. It was just sent out to people. And I kept doing that. And as I did it, I started to notice that I had a little bit of a knack for like making people laugh. And so continued to do that throughout my career. And so by the time I was writing for the Suns, I had built up this shtick. I kind of knew how to write a blog already. And when they asked me to do this for them, I actually was kind of aware, like, this is my chance. I've always wanted to write a book about my career. This might be my chance to, like, get some notice. So people tended to think at the time, like, oh, this guy just tossed this off and it worked out. But a lot of thought had actually gone into being kind of prepared for that moment. Sure enough, it did really well. Bill Simmons from ESPN drew people's attention to it. And Random House actually called me to ask if I wanted to write a book, which happens never. So I was super fortunate in that situation. And then we set about putting it together. It was then a product of a lot of the things that I had written, which we kind of reconditioned and morphed and turned into a journal. A lot of that, I mean, it is presented as a journal, but it, you know, a lot of that has been kind of, not saying it didn't happen, I just mean that we like had to make it presentable as a book. It was exhausting, as you can imagine, to look back at all of the things that I had written very badly and have to make them slightly less bad.
Oh, don't say that. But there was talk at one time where you almost parlayed it into a television pilot or a television show as well. That I guess it didn't happen. It kind of died off. But
it happened, actually.
Did get filmed?
We filmed a pilot. We spent $3.6 million of Fox's money on a pilot. So I have now this 22-minute pilot that if we're ever in the same city, I can show you, which is the product of
$3.5 million.
Not of my money, of course. That happened because when I was looking for a literary agent to represent me for the negotiation of the book deal, I didn't know how to find one. I knew that my aunt and uncle lived in Los Angeles next to some sort of agent. Turns out he was a TV agent. He went through him, got my literary agent, but along the way he said, well, why don't you come up with an idea for a TV show? And I was like, sure. Guy doesn't play very much, is kind of sarcastic and seen. And so we turned that pitch into getting a producer and a writer attached. I was actually just a producer on the show. I was not the writer of it. Wrote a script. 20th Century Fox says, great, we want to make this. So I went to LA and spent like 6 months there, and we filmed the pilot with the likes of Wallace Shawn, who played the agent. Wallace Shawn is the guy from The Princess Bride who says inconceivable, yeah. Little tiny dude, which was a pretty pretty big get for us. There's a guy, I don't know if you've been watching the NBA games, but there's a commercial right now for DirecTV, I think, where the guy like sees the body being put in the car and then ends up like shaving his eyebrows and going to his own funeral.
I haven't seen it. Maybe if I don't have DirecTV, maybe it only airs on DirecTV. So.
Maybe it only directs. I have Time Warner Cable, so maybe it only airs if you have a direct competitor. Anyway, people who are watching the NBA finals or conference finals may recognize this commercial. Anyway, okay. The lead actor in that was the guy who played Adam Rump, who was based on me and my writing.
I was going to ask you who played you, or you know, if you played yourself, or who would you have wanted to play you?
It was that was quite a situation. I actually have had no ever interest in acting, and so when they gave us the go ahead, they said the thing about this is that we're going to have to teach you how to act in case we can't find anyone to play the part of, you know, Paul Shirley's proxy, basically. So for 2 months, every day I went with an acting coach for four hours a day. And by the end, got to be pretty good. And they were struggling to find an actor along the way. We actually passed up Joel McHale, who's the star of Community, which was a mistake because he was great. But they said he didn't look like enough like a basketball player, which I thought was wrong. Anyway, so I got to be pretty good at playing me, which is not really a ringing endorsement of my acting ability. But anyway, I thought I could do this job. But that set up this weird dynamic between me, because at this point I was competitive and I'm thinking like, well, I could just go ahead and do this. And the like executive producer of the show who was saying, I don't want to like direct a guy who's never acted in anything on this thing that is going to make or break my career. So we settled on this other dude who was fine, good guy. He was a little too like Zach Braff-ish from Scrubs, if that means anything. So the show actually looks a lot like if Scrubs were about a basketball team.
So it was kind of like, I don't know if you're a Seinfeld fan, the episode where George and Jerry are there trying to cast their little pilot for their sitcom. It was similar to that.
Yeah, it was quite the learning experience. And I resolved at the time, I don't know if I will ever hold to this, but I was like, I'm going to stick to writing books because you can control everything that goes into it. Because when there's that much money involved, there just get to be so many weird influences, like so many people coming down from studio and just little tiny nitpicky notes that drive you insane. We one time, like this, you know, this is a fairly irreverent show we were trying to make. And we had a scene where we wanted the GM, who was played by Barry Bostwick. Does that name anything to you?
It sounds familiar. I know the name. I probably would know Faith by song.
He was in the Rocky Horror Picture Show and Spin City. He was the mayor on Spin City. Anyway, he's playing the GM. He's an inept GM. And we want to make this joke where somebody has, like, in a flashback, pulled out of a newspaper kiosk a little headline that says, "Is the GM, I can't remember his name, retarded?" It's 2005, so people still thought saying retarded was funny. Anyway, so the standards and practices people come to us because of this, among other things, and say, "We're really sorry, but you can't use that word because the mental health community would not be pleased," which is fine, except for that, as far as I know, being retarded is not like a mental illness. So at least keep your criticism straight. But we did a lot of that, like just stupid, we have to go over this tiny thing. Anyway, books only from now on.
Yeah, there were probably basketball terms like stiffs and that used in it too. The standard and practices would have come down and said that offends white centers everywhere. So you can't use the word stiffs. I mean, would that have applied?
Right. There were a lot of problems because I think when I set out to make or to pitch that show, I wanted to really lambast the NBA and professional sports, but a lot of the people who got involved wanted to make it more about the glamorous side of that. And then we were saying, well, that's what we were trying to make fun of in the start. So the message got mixed. And I think in any time you create a piece of art or anything, you need to have one consistent theme. Like, this is what we're going for. And I think we lost sight of that. Yeah, we need a way to post it online. I don't think I could get – how do you post a 22-minute episode?
We'll talk to Steve, our producer here, and we may be able to do something.
We'll pretend I had nothing to do with it.
Okay, perfect, Paul. A long way from Hollywood is Ames, Iowa, and let's talk about the college career and where I went to school, where you went to school for a few minutes. And one little known fact, probably most people don't know, and maybe you're aware of, but you actually in your college career were a 50% shooter from behind the three-point arc. Did you know that?
I was one of two, maybe?
You were one of two, both in the same game against Northern Iowa in 2004. What was with you that day? Did crack a smile when you hit that one, or the heck happened with that?
What's funny about that is that it's not so much what was with me that day; it was what wasn't with me the rest of the time. Because that's by the end of my basketball career, when I was playing in Spain, basically all I did was shoot three pointers. I was so scared of everything when I got to Iowa State that I didn't want to venture outside of anything that wasn't vaguely comfortable. And I could tell when I got there that the only way I was going to get on the floor was by like playing hard and just sort of not doing a lot of shooting or making mistakes. And because I'm completely OCD, I was terrified of making those mistakes. So I sort of like changed my game and became this weird inside player that I don't even recognize now. Like when I look back at those college days, I'm like, who is that guy? He just dunks occasionally and gets rebounds. And that's no way to have a basketball career. So yeah, I think that was a product of, again, not just having very little confidence in myself and being too afraid to mess up.
That's funny. I said 2004. I think that was in 2000 when that one game where you attempted 2 3-pointers and you hit one of them. So I was actually in the Palace at Auburn Hills, the Michigan State game in the Final Eight. I mean, maybe you still think about it, maybe you don't, but those were probably the two best teams in the country that year meeting in the Final Eight. I contended whoever won that game was going to win the national championship, and you guys were literally within a whisker of winning the game and played maybe one of your best games of the year that day. And, I mean, it was really a fun game to watch. Do you think about that at all and how close you may have been to a national title for Iowa State? I mean, would the world have ended at that point or what?
Only when radio hosts bring it up do I think
about it.
And I get teary-eyed and want to go lay in bed. No, that game is quite the touchstone for Iowa State fans. Like, Iowa State people ask me about it often. I had a very odd role in that game. I had broken my foot, like, 3 weeks beforehand or something against
you were lucky to play.
Oklahoma State or something like that. And so played a very small amount in the game before that against UCLA, I believe. And but the Michigan State game was the first game where I was back. And I, at that time, can't remember junior year. I don't think I started. I was the sixth man most of the time, but I played quite a bit. So anyway, I was playing pretty well. And in the fourth quarter second half, say 6 minutes left, we were up by five. I think this is mostly right. And I came down the lane on offense, caught a pass from one of my teammates and tried to kind of shoot it right as I sort of landed. And at that time, one of Michigan State players kind of ran under me and I smashed into him, and the refs conferred as the basket dropped. And it seemed at the time, because one had called a block, that maybe we were going to go up six, possibly seven if I made the free throw. But then after this conference, they decided to call a double foul, which was unheard of. Nobody ever had seen someone call a double foul. And I fouled out, not that that was like, you know, a determining factor in the win or the loss, but I was playing okay, so it might have been, you know, better to have me on the court. And Michigan State went down and threw an alley-oop to Morris Peterson and all of the green-clad fans, because they're playing in their home state, go crazy. And eventually, Larry Stacey loses his mind and gets kicked out of the game, and we lose. And I cried, and my picture was all over newspapers for crying.
You see, I wasn't going to bring that up, but you did.
Yeah, speaking of formative experiences, I was an emotional basketball player. Like, I would do a lot of crying after losses. And after that game, somebody got a fairly, you know, it's a good picture of a white kid from Kansas playing for Iowa State that looks sad because he's a junior and his dream has just been crushed. And so I can respect that. But, you know, it wasn't that much fun to be the subject of it. I got over that loss kind of by, you know, Sunday, and Monday morning woke up fresh at Ames, Iowa, thinking like, well, got to go back to class and finish out this terrible engineering degree, and then we'll get them next year and whatever will happen. So I go to the dorm at Friley Hall, where I ate my breakfast every morning, and pick up a newspaper and turn it over, and the entire front page of the Iowa State Daily is my sad face crying all over myself. And so the smart thing to do would have been to just go home, because I, you know, I don't need to deal with everybody seeing my crying face all day. But I didn't, and I went to class. And imagine this, talk about, like, this is kind of boastful but terrible at the same time. During that day, a girl came up to me in the library where I was studying and asked me to autograph a picture of me crying.
That's Iowa for you.
Which I thought was gutsy, and I did, even while saying, we lost, we're terrible, you don't want my autograph, but she still did.
The Iowa State basketball program is, has gone through many changes since you left, and now actually there's a coach in place that, you know, couldn't be more popular, I'm sure, has Coach Hoiberg reached out to the former players, and has he kind of brought you guys back in a little bit? Or what do you think of the job that Fred's doing? And I know you still, even during the NCAA tournament, you said you found yourself, you couldn't believe it, you found yourself back rooting, watching Iowa State and rooting for them. And are you kind of on board with what Fred's doing and looking to do?
Yeah, definitely. He's a really good dude, and that helps. Like, it makes it way easier to root for that team. I didn't feel like I had a lot of connection with the Iowa State program as soon as they fired Eustace and then went on the, like, Wayne Morgan experiment. It just seemed like everything had dissipated. This, though, feels right. And for whatever reason, it makes a lot of sense to me to have him there. I'm glad they've got him locked up, theoretically, with a contract. Although, God, that's a lot of money. It's amazing how, I mean, I'm totally supportive of Fred Hoiberg, think he's great. But if I were running things, I'm not sure I would say, well, after two okay years, here's all this money. But I'm not in charge. So good for Fred Hoiberg, and I hope that Iowa State does well. I will say it's interesting from my perspective. I have nothing but good things to say about the people of Iowa and how they embraced me. But what one thing people don't necessarily always understand about being a player at a college like Iowa State is that mostly we were mercenaries kind of brought in, not because we were loyal to, like, we weren't from Iowa. We weren't, you know, Jamal Tinsley didn't probably know where Ames, Iowa was when he signed with them.
Did he know where the library was?
What's up?
Did he know where the library was?
I doubt it. He didn't graduate from high school, so I don't think he was really too worried about, you know, book learning. And so it's always kind of a I'm always putting my foot in my mouth because I want to be honest with people and say, like, hey, you know, I liked being at Iowa State, but I would have gone to Tennessee if Tennessee had offered me a contract or a scholarship. It's just that Iowa State was the place that wanted me. And so for that, I'm thankful. But mostly that's because of Tim Floyd, because he's the one who wanted me. It's not like you guys, the fans, recruited me. So that always makes that puts people off because they want to hear, like, oh, I'm a rabid, like, alumnus and whatever. And I am very supportive. I like the sort of long-suffering Chicago Cubsian attitude that Iowa State fans, I dig that. But I always want to be honest with people about, like, that, you know, I don't think Cantrell Horton is sitting around thinking about Iowa State right now. Like, that's just the way that it is, unfortunately.
Well, I haven't talked to him lately, so I don't know for sure. But I know Iowa State fans did like you, and they still do like you. And, I mean, they like you, the type of player you were. That's the, you know, even though you weren't from Iowa, I mean, that was the type of player they liked. And I mean, they still, I mean, if they mention your name, the Iowa State alumni that I know, it brings a smile to their face. So I don't know if it's because
I was the consolation prize in the Nick Collison and Kirk Heinrich.
Don't say that. Trade. Don't say that.
Well, no, I mean, that's true. Like, I was, Collison and Heinrich get away and Iowa State got me instead. And no, I certainly recognize that I fit with the personality that an Iowa State fan would enjoy. And I dug that. And I had, again, I have great things to say about Iowa State fans and the people in Iowa. So welcoming, such good people, smarter than people from Kansas, more dedicated to education, love all of those things. But I think people forget that there were a lot of really terrible things going on within the basketball program. Sure. And so if I don't have fond memories of Iowa State, sometimes it's probably because I was around some really terrible human beings on the basketball team with me. And so it's hard for me to dissociate, like, the fans from the experience. The fans were always amazing, and people in Iowa were always amazing. But my teammates sometimes were terrible. And so, like, that means that I don't necessarily have, like, you know, just confetti and popcorn memories of my time at Iowa State.
No, but you're a good guy, and you can kind of separate the two, so a lot of people can't do that. So that's good to hear. Give us an NBA prediction for who you think is going to make the finals and maybe a final prediction from your vantage point.
Man, it's so confusing now because I was sure that the Spurs were going to win. And I'm going to say, wait, like, I saw the Spurs. I'm pretty good friends with Matt Bonner now, who's best guy ever. And so went with him, his brother, and my brother. No, not him, because he was playing. Sorry, went with his brother and my brother to watch him play when they played the Clippers when I was in L.A. in, like, February. And they just dismantled the Clippers, and Greg Popovich looked so smart. And at this time, they didn't even have Boris Diaw and Steven Jackson. So as soon as they signed those guys, I thought, this is no-brainer. Like, people won't see this coming, but the Spurs are going to win it. And I thought that was going to happen in part because of the shortened season, that Popovich's coaching acumen would, like, just outweigh everything else. But I was wrong, and the Spurs look too old, and now I'm sad. What do you like? What was your take on that?
Pretty much the same. Looks like they got tired in a span of about two games, mm-hmm. and Oklahoma City looks fresh. I mean, it's really something. But the Celtics are battling the Heat, and I don't know what's going to happen there now.
Yeah, I probably should stop writing about basketball because last week's column I wrote how the Celtics have just wasted these Hall of Famers and how Doc Rivers needs to be run out on the rail because he's been good, but you've only won one championship with three of these four actually. You could say four Hall of Famers probably on the same team. But now that's proving to be completely incorrect, and they look like they might have a chance. Although I just have this sense that doesn't the NBA need LeBron James to be in the finals for marketing reasons?
I think so. A LeBron versus Kevin Durant finals would probably generate some pretty big ratings.
Yeah, you can't say it's fixed because it's not fixed, but you should always remember that in the back of the mind of the NBA executives, there is this need to make money. And so don't be surprised if that's how it ends up.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. And I think that, I don't know if you've ever been approached for it, but since you're based most of the time in Kansas City, now that you're retired, I thought you would have been a great analyst for Big 12 basketball on TV on the Big 12 network there. So I don't know if they've ever approached you, but if they ever do, you should, I think that's your calling. You should definitely be with a microphone in front, maybe not your face on the screen, but you could be talking about it and you got great insights.
Thanks. I think I would implode at some point is the only problem. I just wouldn't be able to take it. I'd be like, that was such a terrible shot. Like that guy should be put on the bench and kept there forever.
Or I was worried maybe you might have a flashback, Larry Eustace chewing out flashback, and you would all of a sudden just lose it on the air. We don't need any more crying pictures of you. So,
right. We don't need more tearful pictures of
you. Yeah, last question I ask all my guests as we wrap up. And in your writing or just in your personal life, I know you love music and the one piece of modern technology you can't live without and maybe the best new band that you've seen and recently.
I hate being a part of any sort of fad or cult. And so I'm always resistant of the Apple world because of that. I think Apple people are weird and should be avoided. But this MacBook that I'm using right now, this MacBook Pro, which is basically the hub of my universe, is pretty hard to beat. That seems so generic and stupid. But it amazes me that Apple still only has, I don't know what it is. It's something ridiculously small, 15% of the computing.
It's growing though.
Population. Yeah, it's certainly growing, but it always amazes me that it's so small. And I was the biggest skeptic. I just didn't want to be a part of that. But once you get one, you're like, oh, yeah, everything works. It's supposed to work.
Yeah, I agree. What about a great new band that you've seen that we're gonna hear some from? And maybe a tried and true band that you like and they've been around for a while that you still like and you can always listen to. Give us a couple picks there.
Here's a band, a Canadian band that's won a couple of Juno Awards, which is the Canadian Grammys. A band called the Arkells, Arkells. Very Bruce Springsteen-y, kind of straight ahead rock and roll. I think it's almost impossible not to like them. I'm going tonight actually to watch a band in Kansas City. They're not from Kansas City, called Valiant Thor, which is this weird kind of metal, kind of a joke, but not really band. And if anyone ever gets the chance to see Valiant Thor live, you should make that happen. And then tried and true band, let's see. I've been listening to a lot of, they're not that tried and true, but I've been listening to a lot of the Silver Sun Pickups lately. LA band has three or four.
LA band. Okay. Some good picks. I may check a couple of the songs out, but the Arkells is one to watch. Huh?
Mm-hmm. I would, I'd pay attention to them.
Okay. We'll do that. Paul, give us how to... fans can follow your writings again and your Twitter account and where they can follow you, and just really appreciate you having you on.
Of course. On Twitter, I'm Paul Then Shirley. And by the way, I've never gotten to say this to anyone. I've always wanted to explain this.
All right, an exclusive.
One of the things I hated about sports was that it was so militaristic in one of the manifestations of that, it was that people are always calling you by your last name, which I kind of find dehumanizing, especially because my last name is a girl's name. And so my Twitter name is Paul Then Shirley, which is sort of a joke on don't ever put the Shirley first, which kind of comes from the airplane joke also. So anyway, that's how you find me on Twitter. It's Paul, T-H-E-N, Shirley. And then I write, of course, you can find a lot of my stuff at Flip Collective, which is this site I run. And that's about it.
Yeah, you and your brother do a good job with that site. And I wasn't going to ask you, and I'm not going to ask you how many times you've heard the Leslie Nielsen airplane reference. So you mentioned it kind of off power, so I'm not even going to go there.
When I was playing for a minor league team, quick story because I know we're about out of time, but when I was playing for a minor league team in Kansas City, they had nicknames for every player, and every time you scored, they would say that nickname. And it was the minor leagues, so I scored quite a lot, actually,
yeah.
Because it's the minor leagues. And they would say, every time I scored, "That's Paul, don't call me Shirley," for two, which was funny one time. Not funny the other 160,000 times.
That's great. You're a good storyteller, Paul, and you're even a better writer and a great person, and we'll appreciate talking to you and enjoy the band tonight, and just hold on for a second and I'll wrap up the show here and had a good time.
Great. All right.
Netcast Studio has many other shows which may interest you. You can head over to netcaststudio.com and check them out. They have shows about Google and education, and the tech of sports is one of the shows. So head over there, check out the variety of content available. You've been listening to the Tech of Sports and Netcast Studio production.